Hello, and welcome to episode number 58 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. Last time on this podcast, we discussed Jacques Vallée's groundbreaking and genre-stretching book, Passport to Magonia, From Folklore to Flying Saucers, which highlights striking parallels between elements found within what's commonly referred to as the UFO phenomenon and distant tales that come to us from so-called fairy lore. That is to say, once you crack the veneer of more recent 20th and 21st century encounters with what are assumed to be spacecraft being piloted by alien beings who've supposedly traveled across the vast distances of the cosmos to get here, and the stories of our ancestors' encounters with the likes of fauns, fairies, and goblins from the annals of human history, the degree of overlap is as startling as it is, at least from Vallée's perspective, potentially revealing. Put succinctly, Vallée, and others since he first penned this book in the late 1960s, have wondered if perhaps some kind of intelligence has been interacting with human beings throughout the entire course of our history, and either that we've just interpreted them differently because of our changing assumptions about reality, or that the very manner in which they appear to us is partly determined by cultural constructs. Incidentally, this latter possibility may even explain some of the differences noted not only across time, but also between different cultures existing contemporaneously around the world. When one peruses the full breadth of the history of these kinds of interactions with beings that appear to be decidedly non-human, one particular element stands out. Here I speak of the degree of absurdity, elsewhere described as ridiculousness, that arises in many of these cases. And again, this is often as true of cases of what at first glance appear to be standard extraterrestrials flying spacecraft, as it does of fairies abducting human beings and then returning them only after having altered that individual's relationship with space-time in one way or another, at least temporarily. While we might ignore elements of absurdity apparent in historic cases of fairy lore because, after all, few modern people take these stories seriously to begin with. After all, they're fairy tales, a genre many take to mean made up or not real or fantastical. However, what is disconcerting to some who like to cling to a standard extraterrestrial hypothesis to explain modern incidences of the UFO phenomenon, here too the accounts provided reveal elements of what appears to be pure absurdity, elements of ridiculousness that surely have no place if we're speaking of sophisticated, technologically superior entities traveling from exoplanets to survey our blue pearl of a planet. Why the absurdity? And why so often? What are we to make of this? Is this merely attributable to errors in translation or something equally banal? Or is this seeming ridiculousness pointing to something more central, something serving perhaps as a signpost pointing towards the murky origin of these various non-human others, or at least some of them? These are the very matters we'll seek to explore in this, the 58th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. Let's begin this week's podcast with a definition. What do we mean when we use this term absurd? Absurdity is the quality or state of being ridiculous or wildly unreasonable. Something absurd is really silly, absolutely ridiculous, or total nonsense, in other words. An example I found was, quote, thinking you can wear flip-flops and a bikini to the North Pole is an absurd idea. If you run into someone dressed in an absurd outfit or watch a movie full of absurd jokes, you'll probably have a good laugh. In other words, it means utterly or obviously senseless, illogical, or untrue. Another way to put it is contrary to all reason or common sense, laughably foolish or false. So it's the extreme nature of the falseness or the foolishness here that reveals something as absurd. But another key I want to point out is that absurdity is always context dependent. Something can only be regarded as absurd in comparison with a norm. That is how it's defined, in other words, which is always a social construct. In other words, what's considered absurd in one culture might not necessarily be the same in another culture. Now, because people are entering this conversation with different points of familiarity with the data behind the UFO phenomenon, perhaps some people are not familiar with the absurd nature of some of the data. So we should go over some of that. Now, while we as a culture, as a society, mostly because of our cultural expectations, assume these others buzzing in and around our skies are space aliens, some of the details of people's encounters with them stretch this explanation. Or at the very least, the interactions defy conventional expectations of what space aliens would look like and do, how they would conduct their affairs, and what they'd be interested in. All of these matters are stretched when you actually read about people's encounters with these supposed space aliens. They don't do what we expect them to do. They often don't look like what we expect them to look like. Now, again, our assumptions could be wrong. Our expectations, again, are culturally dependent, so those could be off. Nevertheless, what we find seems absurd, and we'll discuss more why that's the case. We should also point out that even the crafts themselves, sometimes, when examined closely, don't often resemble what we assume to be advanced technological devices. Is it possible that this is because they're simply so advanced that they defy even our imagination of what such vehicles would look like? Perhaps, but this begs the question, why do they engage in other activities that seem so counter to our expectations of what an advanced alien species would do? Here we think of the bizarre and often unnecessarily invasive and painful medical procedures conducted, and various elements of their supposed hybridization programs. What is that about? Why would space aliens want our DNA to begin with? And even if they did, by some stretch of the imagination, why can't they just raid a sperm bank covertly? Why the need for the bizarre, near ritualistic practices, which again look quite similar to ritualistic practices from distant human lore, as Vallée has pointed out in a couple of his different books? So far we've touched on the way they look, their appearance, and how that seems to fly in the face of what we might expect from a space alien. For instance, why do they look so humanoid and sometimes quite human? And if not human, they look reptilian or something like a being that might have evolved on the Earth. If they're coming from a distant planet with supposedly a completely different ecosystem, different environmental conditions, why would the evolutionary process produce a being so much like one that might have arisen on the Earth? That's the first thing. The second thing is the way the craft look. Often they don't look like the kind of vehicles that have traveled across the cosmos, at least what we would expect. Now again, we could be wrong about that, our expectations could be off, but nevertheless, it's one more data point that is surprising. Now another data point that some people consider absurd is the origin that these others sometimes give when people ask them where they came from. Again, the questions themselves make it very clear that we think they're space aliens coming from some exoplanet, but sometimes the answer that has been provided, historically, doesn't make sense. Either right away you talk to an astronomer and he'll know that it doesn't make sense what they're saying, or what they say is so vague that you can't possibly place it on a star map, for instance. And perhaps the person that's being told this, the abductee or the contactee, doesn't know enough about space to know that. Or they'll give some sort of location that at the time seems plausible, but as the decades go on and we learn more about the cosmos, we find that such a location isn't likely at all. So why would they give these seemingly absurd answers when they could give answers that would at least be intelligible and commonsensical? Why do they give us these answers that in retrospect sometimes just seem absurd on the face of it? Now, one possibility that we've discussed on this podcast in previous episodes touches on what some intel has exposed, suggesting that perhaps these others, at least some of them, are actually future humans who are merely telling us they're space aliens so as to cover over their true origin and to keep us in the dark as to their intention to change our timeline, our very future, by their presence in our midst. In other words, if they're actually humans from here, but from the future, they might give us a false answer to throw us off their scent. But again, you would still ask the question, why give absurd answers though? If they know us well and they know our timeline well, after all, we're supposed to be their ancestors, why wouldn't they be able to give an intelligible answer to cover their tracks even more? Again, why the need for seemingly absurd responses to the question as to where they're coming from? By the way, I'd also like to point out that on any one of these matters, you might excuse it and say it's not such a big deal. But when you look at the pattern of data in a totality, you begin to wonder why there's so many elements that seem slightly off, not quite what we would expect. Again, you could chalk this up to our mere expectations being wrong, our assumptions being off base, but it does make you wonder. Now, perhaps so far you're just not that convinced. When you hear the data points I've brought up already, they don't add up to much in your mind. Perhaps you can excuse all of that as just being errors in translation or an issue with our expectations being off or what have you. But the elements of absurdity go much beyond those, go far beyond those. Let's now discuss a very specific case related to something we talked about last week and how absurdity seems to be baked into the very core of this case. And I use the word baked as a bit of a play on words there. You'll understand why in a moment. Again, this is a case we discussed last week in brief in the discussion about Passport to Magonia. I would like to revisit it now and then consider each of the elements within this case. Quoting again from Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia, quote, "It was an unusual day for the Food and Drug Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare when the Air Force requested an analysis of a piece of wheat cake that had been cooked aboard a flying saucer. The human being who had obtained the cake was Joe Simonton, a 60-year-old chicken farmer who lived alone in a small house in the vicinity of Eagle River, Wisconsin. He was given three cakes, ate one of them, and thought it tasted like cardboard. The Air Force put it more scientifically. Quote, the cake was composed of hydrogenated fat, starch, buckwheat hulls, soybean hulls, wheat bran. Bacteria and radiation readings were normal for this material. Chemical, infrared, and other destructive type tests were run on the material. The Food and Drug Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare concluded that the material was an ordinary pancake of terrestrial origin. Where did it come from? The reader will have to decide for himself what he chooses to believe after reading the second chapter. It begins with the Eagle River incident because this is a first-hand account given by a man of absolute sincerity. Speaking for the U.S. Air Force, Dr. Alan Hynek, who investigated the case, along with Major Robert Friend and an officer from Sawyer Air Force Base, stated, quote, there is no question that Mr. Simonton felt that his contact had been a real experience, unquote. And now let's get to the incident itself. Quoting again from the book, quote, the time was approximately 11 a.m. on April 18, 1961, when Joe Simonton was attracted outside by a peculiar noise similar to knobby tires on wet pavement. Stepping into his yard, he faced a silvery, saucer-shaped object brighter than chrome, which appeared to be hovering close to the ground without actually touching it. The object was about 12 feet high and 30 feet in diameter. A hatch opened about 5 feet from the ground, and Simonton saw three men inside the machine. One of them was dressed in a black two-piece suit. The occupants were about 5 feet in height. Smooth-shaven, they appeared to resemble Italians. They had dark hair and skin and wore outfits with turtleneck tops and knit helmets. One of the men held up a jug apparently made of the same material as the saucer. His motions to Joe Simonton seemed to indicate that he needed water. Simonton took the jug, went inside the house, and filled it. As he returned, he saw that one of the men inside the saucer was frying food on a flameless grill of some sort. The interior of the ship was black, the color of wrought iron. Simonton, who could see several instrument panels, heard a slow whining sound, similar to the hum of a generator. When he made a motion indicating he was interested in the food that was being prepared, one of the men, who was also dressed in black but with a narrow red trim along the trousers, handed him three cakes, about 3 inches in diameter and perforated with small holes. The whole affair had lasted about 5 minutes. Finally, the man closest to the witness attached a kind of belt to a hook in his clothing and closed the hatch in such a way that Simonton could scarcely detect its outline. Then the object rose about 20 feet from the ground before taking off straight south, causing a blast of air that bowed some nearby pine trees. Along the edge of the saucer, the witness recalls, were exhaust pipes 6 or 7 inches in diameter. The hatch was about 6 feet high and 30 inches wide, and although the object has always been described as a saucer, its shape was that of 2 inverted bowls, unquote. Now, in a moment, we'll get to what the Air Force concluded about this case and what psychologists in nearby Dayton, Ohio, also signed off on in terms of the explanation of what actually happened. Because, as I'm sure you'll agree, there are some very strange elements, strange bedfellows that you don't usually get together in a UFO incident. But before we go much further, I want to remind you that in addition to seeing a flying saucer and encountering supposedly alien beings, Joe Simonton was also given an artifact, given these 3 pancakes, 2 of which were handed over to the U.S. Air Force, and those were subsequently analyzed. So we have here an artifact manifesting in consensus reality. I want you to keep that in mind because that is key. This clearly cannot be purely a waking dream, because if that was the case, where did the pancakes come from? I also want to remind you that people like J. Allen Hynek were involved with this case, so there is a high bar to pass in terms of credibility of the witness. And apparently Simonton passed that with flying colors. So you can't merely dismiss this as a witness who's lying or is delusional. And even if you want to do that in this case, there are many other cases just like it. And surely you can't dismiss them all, because at that point you're just basically excluding evidence that you find inconvenient. Okay, now let's touch on some of the elements from this case, from this narrative that is described by Joe Simonton. And we'll touch on both ones that seem to fit with a saucer narrative, in other words, ETs flying a craft, and other elements that don't seem to fit at all, that seem to be jagged right angle fits in terms of that narrative. First of all, he's drawn outside by a sound. That's not uncommon. That's quite common for these kinds of cases, and one would expect that that might happen. Nothing strange there. Now, next, we hear that stepping into his yard, he faced a silvery saucer-shaped object brighter than chrome, which appeared to be hovering close to the ground without actually touching it. Now again, perfectly reasonable. Saucer-shaped, brighter than chrome, not actually touching the ground. That all sounds like a UFO, sounds like a sophisticated vehicle operating advanced technology. All good so far. But then we get to this point. A hatch opened about 5 feet from the ground, and Simonton saw 3 men inside the machine. About 5 feet in height, smooth-shaven, they appeared to, quote, resemble Italians, unquote. Now again, if these are space aliens, why are they looking anything like humans, let alone humans that are so specific that we can even attach a certain ethnicity to them? Very strange. And we should also point out that their height, which is somewhat lower than average, is quite common in these cases as well. That's a big part of this literature, is that the beings, whether they're the small grays or what have you, often seem to be not quite the height of conventional human beings, which again, you could argue points more towards some sort of non-conventional human species existing on the Earth or some breakaway civilization that seems more likely than space aliens who just happen to look human, and so human that we can say, hey, they look like Italians. All right, next element. One of the men held up a jug apparently made of the same material as a saucer. Okay, that's reasonable. Could be the same material. But then he motions to Joe Simonton, seeming to indicate that he needed water. Really? So they're out flying their spacecraft and they run out of water, which they keep in a jug, so much so that they have to stop and ask for some? Even stranger, this is quite common. There are cases like this going back into the 19th century even, when the so-called airships would land and beings that looked like human beings would ask for various materials, including things like water or some kind of food. Again, not what you'd expect a space alien to do. You come all the way from Alpha Centauri, but you forget to bring enough water. Or perhaps you're on a shuttle, taking a day trip from the mothership that's orbiting the Earth, in stealth perhaps. For the sake of argument, let's say that's what's happening. Really, you don't bring enough water to last a whole voyage? Again, seems like a stretch if it's the alien UFO narrative we're going with. Next, we hear that Simonton took the jug, went inside the house, and filled it. As he returned, he saw that one of the men inside the saucer was, quote, frying food on a flameless grill of some sort, unquote. So again, really? You're in a spacecraft and you're using a flameless grill? Again, I guess it's possible that you're frying food that way. I would think they would at least have microwaves or something, but no, they're frying food. Okay, we'll accept that. Moving on. Simonton, who could see several instrument panels, heard a slow whining sound similar to the hum of a generator. Again, sounds reasonable. They have to power it somehow. He saw instrument panels. We'd expect that with UFOs, right? If they're space alien craft. And presumably you would hear some sort of engine, even if it's an anti-grav engine. Then finally we hear the whole affair had lasted about 5 minutes. Finally, the man closest to the witness attached a kind of belt to a hook in his clothing and closed the hatch. That sounds like a strange way to do that from a technological point of view, but okay. But then we hear that he closed the hatch in such a way that Simonton could scarcely detect its outline. Now that does sound high tech, that the seamless nature of the ports and whatnot, we hear about that, that there's no rivets, no bolts, nothing like that. That it seems to be a seamless exterior texture. That fits with that narrative right there. Then we hear the object rose about 20 feet from the ground before taking off straight south, causing a blast of air that bowed some nearby pine trees. So once again, there we have a case of manifest reality being impacted by this craft when the pine trees bend over, according to Simonton's account. So looking back at the elements we just discussed, there are some that fit your typical ET flying a spacecraft kind of narrative, and other elements that stick out like sore thumbs that don't make any sense whatsoever, that if you're honest with yourself, you have to say that's the furthest thing from what you expected from space aliens. What are we to make of that? That's exactly the kind of absurdity that Vallée and others are pointing to. And of course, Vallée goes further than that, and we touched on this last week, discussing these same kinds of elements showing up in fairy lore, even to the point where they would show up and ask for things like water, because that's supposedly what they drink, only water. And they handed him cakes. And just like Joe Simonton, they often provide food that is saltless, by the way. And when they did the examination, the analysis of these pancakes, they had no salt, apparently. So again, Vallée draws that parallel as well. So while some are incredulous and refuse to believe that this has anything to do with fairy lore, you've got elements that don't at all fit with your typical ET alien kind of hypothesis, and they do have elements that fit with the stories we hear from distant human lore regarding the Fae. Why would that be the case? We have to make sense of that. Now, one wonders, how would the Air Force resolve this case? What would they conclude about the bizarre juxtaposition of weird elements that appeared together? Well, Vallée says, quote, "The Eagle River case has never been solved. The Air Force believes that Joe Simonton, who lived alone, had a sudden dream while he was awake and inserted his dream into the continuum of events around him of which he was conscious. I understand several psychologists in Dayton, Ohio, are quite satisfied with this explanation, and so are most serious amateur ufologists. Alas, ufology, like psychology, has become such a narrow field of specialization that the experts have no time left for general culture. They are so busy rationalizing the dreams of other people that they themselves do not dream anymore, nor do they read fairy tales. If they did, they would perhaps take a much closer look at Joe Simonton and his pancakes. They would know about the gentry and the food from fairyland." Unquote. Now, along with Vallée, I find it bizarre, almost hilarious, what the Air Force concludes, along with several psychologists in Dayton, Ohio. No serious explanation is offered as to how someone would insert a dream into the continuum of their waking and walking events. That's never explained. Rather, what we see here is that we have a notion of how reality works. Certain things happen in dreams, and certain other things happen when you're awake. And all they've done here is said, aha, these are dreamlike things, so we'll just smash those together into this waking state without explaining exactly how that happened, and then our prevailing understanding of how the world works is protected. Notice both the Air Force and psychologists in Dayton, Ohio were okay with this explanation, but when you really examine it, it doesn't make any sense. It's actually not explaining anything. It's just piecing together a narrative after the fact that allows for the preservation of the current mainstream understanding of what is possible in our reality. In other words, that's a farce of an investigation. Perhaps you'll agree. Now, of course, according to how science should be conducted, when you come across outlier data that doesn't fit with your prevailing worldview, your paradigm, you should investigate all the more, because this could be a very valuable clue telling you that something about your current paradigm is incomplete. Alas, that's often not what happens. Often what happens is the inconvenient data is just explained away, dismissed, or ridiculed. That's been the history of the UFO phenomenon, of course, and that's why we've made so little progress after all these decades. Now, I would argue that Jacques Vallée himself has changed his perspective a few times, or at least shifted somewhat, in terms of how he deals with this absurdity. This is what he was known as saying at one point, quote, "There is a feeling that I get in the course of my investigations of being in the presence of a form of consciousness that is truly remarkable. That consciousness has a great sense of absurdity and also a great sense of humor. The bottom line is that I feel that I've learned something out of this whole exercise, and as long as I'm continuing to learn something, I'm going to continue to do it." Unquote. Now, more recently, of course, Vallée has talked more about these kinds of absurd events or elements as perhaps being a coded message. We think of his book Trinity, The Best Kept Secret, which he co-authored along with Paola Harris, which talked about a craft that crashed very soon after the very first ever atomic bomb test, and in the very same area as where that test was conducted. Vallée and Harris and others have postulated that perhaps that crash wasn't a crash at all, and that we shouldn't look at it merely at face value, but rather see it as some kind of intelligence saying, hey, look over here, we need to bring your attention right here. And of course, what's happening right there at that time? It's the detonating of an atomic bomb as part of a test. But again, as Vallée points out in that book, it was a massive bomb. So again, in other words, the coded message there is that crashes in the desert are actually more like signal flares designed to draw our attention to the dangers of atomic weapons. We know, of course, that it didn't just happen there at the Trinity test site. It also happened in Roswell, which is also close to where atomic bombs were being tested. So again, there's different ways that Vallée and others have tried to make sense of this absurdity over time. Because absurdity doesn't have to mean meaningless, and it's important to make that distinction. Sometimes the absurdity provides a kind of meaning that you couldn't arrive at otherwise. For instance, Vallée has often talked about this as being a kind of koan move. And here we think of koans in terms of Zen Buddhism. In fact, Vallée has been quoted as saying about these situations that they, quote, "often have the deep, poetic, and paradoxical quality of Eastern religious tales," unquote. In a 1978 interview with Fate magazine, he described this further, saying, quote, "If you're trying to express something which is beyond the comprehension of a subject, you have to do it through statements that appear contradictory or seem absurd. For example, in Zen Buddhism, the seeker must deal with such concepts as, quote, the sound of one hand clapping, unquote, an apparently preposterous notion which is designed to break down ordinary ways of thinking," unquote. So again, the point here is this is pointing towards some sort of metalogical device, that when the way we think about the world itself is the problem, perhaps absurdity would be used as a kind of koan move to break us out of that thinking, to open up intuitive ways of seeing reality differently, and perhaps more directly. So far we've covered a couple of different ways that people have tried to make sense of this absurdity, to propose meaning behind the absurdity, via coded messages and things like koan moves. Another possibility that arises is higher dimensional space disparities. Now, to bring your attention to this, I would point out that there was a book written in the past called Flatland, which describes beings living in a two-dimensional space, and they are confounded by the actions of someone who is existing in three-dimensional space. And of course, if you live in three-dimensional space, you can do things that end up looking bizarre and absurd to the beings living in two-dimensional space. So to use that analogy here, the idea is that if this is some sort of entity or intelligence or group of beings coming from fifth-dimensional space or something like that, their behavior would look paradoxical, bizarre, and even perhaps absurd to us. This is yet another way that people try to make sense of the apparent absurdity in the data. A final possibility that I would postulate that others have pointed out to me as well, specifically people who've had encounters with the Greys, is that the end goal is just secrecy for the sake of secrecy. That perhaps this is like a sleight of hand trick where they are distracting us on one level while doing something deeper and potentially more nefarious on another level. So in other words, according to this possibility, the absurdity is just meant to confound us, to confuse us, to obfuscate what is actually going on. I would also add that you could suggest this is a cultural mismatch, that again, there are translation errors, and that's why things look so bizarre. But the part that's hard to reconcile with that notion is that some elements do seem to fit our cultural expectations, while others are jarring exceptions to that rule. So why would that be the case? From my point of view, cultural differences alone don't fully explain the degree of absurdity apparent in these kind of encounters over the course of history. And for that matter, the idea that this is just done to confound us while secretive things are done that are more nefarious, that also doesn't seem like the best fit of the data from my point of view. If their goal was merely to confuse us and distract us, they could do it through other means. I think that the absurdity is pointing to something more than that. At least some elements of the absurdity are pointing towards something else entirely. Now, elsewhere, Valet has also spoken about the absurdity as part of his control system hypothesis, specifically that you could use absurdity to change the course of human history on an unconscious level, that's where you sort of lever the change. And you could do that right underneath the noses of the powerful elite, because the absurdity distracts them, keeps their attention elsewhere. They don't pay attention to it because of the absurdity itself. These are a couple of statements that Valet has made to that effect in his book, Messengers of Deception. Quote, "The social sciences have not yet achieved an understanding of the process by which new religious experiences arise and new sects become influential churches. Also, revolutionary cultural changes often appear at first, as the UFO sects do today, to be irrational, absurd, and contemptible," unquote. He also said, quote, "The new belief is completely lacking in logic. That is the key to its power. It serves to keep scientists away. The more absurd the statement, the stronger its effect. When the establishment is rational, the irrationality is dynamite," unquote. And again, that points to what I was just talking about, that you can keep the establishment, the powers that be, distracted because they won't pay attention when absurdity is in the mix. But the populace can be greatly affected. And Valet's point is that already happens with churches and cults and whatnot. And at the time that he wrote these two books, Passport to Magonia and Messengers of Deception, he was proposing that perhaps we would see the formation of churches, religious organizations, built around the mythos of these benign alien visitors. As it turns out, that didn't really happen historically. We have to point that out. But nevertheless, this is a really insightful point that Valet is making about how absurdity can become a subversive means to control an entire populace. And now I'd like to leave you with a few concluding thoughts to consider. First off, from my point of view, a key endeavor we should engage in, as I've been saying for some time now, is to see if we can tease out of the data certain patterns indicating different actors, agendas, and origins from within the totality of the data. Of course, we have to be careful to not merely see what we want to see, i.e. confirmation bias, but with appropriate checks and balances in place, I think this can be done and done effectively. We should also remember that while you can't recreate the UFO phenomenon under lab conditions, generally speaking, you can test a hypothesis by seeing how historic cases fit, similar to what we do with evolution and the fossil record. Ultimately, we should favor hypotheses that fit the data as closely as possible. As we often find with the UFO phenomenon, the elements of absurdity need to be parsed out as much as possible because I believe they can perhaps best be attributed to different origins. Of course, this is tricky because so much of this process comes down to our own subjective impressions regarding what is and isn't absurd or unreasonable to begin with. Once we've done this, I feel like we might see over time that different elements emerge from within that blended totality we call the UFO phenomenon. Now, some elements may be cleaner than others. I think these cleaner, less convoluted elements point perhaps to a different origin than those emblazoned with bizarre elements of absurdity. I think this latter kind are pointing perhaps to a different source altogether, one that is not actually one of the usual players we think of in terms of the various common hypotheses put forward to explain the UFO phenomenon. Here I speak of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, the interdimensional hypothesis, the future human hypothesis, the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis, etc. An alternative hypothesis postulated to specifically make sense of the group of others embedded within this particular fog of absurdity is something I plan to continue to roll out piece by piece over the course of time on this podcast. So I hope you'll continue to tune in as we proceed with this fascinating discussion in the weeks and months to come. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exo Academian signing out.